Across the Sea of Stars by Arthur C. Clarke. History Lesson Continued. There was no way forward. Through all the years of flight, the glaciers from the south had been advancing to meet them. Soon they would be crushed beneath the moving walls of ice. Southern glaciers did not reach the mountains until a generation later. In that last summer, the sons of Shan carried the sacred treasures of the tribe to the lonely cairn overlooking the plain. The ice that had once gleamed below the horizon was now almost at their feet. By spring, it would be splintering against the mountain walls. No one understood the treasures now. They were from a past too distant for the understanding of any man alive. Their origins were lost in the mists that surrounded the Golden Age, and how they had come at last into the possession of this wandering tribe was a story that now would never be told. For it was the story of a civilization that had passed beyond recall. Once all these pitiful relics had been treasured for some good reason, and now they had become sacred, though their meaning had long been lost. The print in the old books had faded centuries ago, though much of the lettering was still visible, if there had been anyone to read it. But many generations had passed since anyone had had a use for a set of seven-figure logarithms, an atlas of the world, and the score of Sibelius's Seventh Symphony printed, according to the flyleaf, by H.K. Chu and Sons at the city of Pekin in the year 2371 A.D. The old books were placed reverently in the little crypt that had been made to receive them. There followed a motley collection of fragments, gold and platinum coins, a broken telephoto lens, a watch, a cold light lamp, a microphone, the cutter from an electric razor, some midget radio tubes, the flotsam that had been left behind when the great tide of civilization had ebbed forever. All these treasures were carefully stowed away in their resting place. Then came three more relics, the most sacred of all because the least understood. The first was a strangely shaped piece of metal, showing the coloration of intense heat. It was, in its way, the most pathetic of all these symbols from the past, for it told of man's greatest achievement and of the future he might have known. The mahogany stand on which it was mounted bore a silver plate with the inscription, Auxiliary Igniter from Starboard Jet, Spaceship Morning Star, Earth Moon, A.D. 1985. Next followed another miracle of the ancient science. A sphere of transparent plastic with strangely shaped pieces of metal embedded in it. At its center was a tiny capsule of synthetic radio element, surrounded by the converting screens that shifted its radiation far down the spectrum. As long as the material remained active, the sphere would be a tiny radio transmitter, broadcasting power in all directions. Only a few of these spheres had ever been made. They had been designed as perpetual beacons to mark the orbits of the asteroids. But man had never reached the asteroids, and the beacons had never been used. Last of all was a flat, circular tin, wide in comparison with its depth. It was heavily sealed and rattled when shaken. The tribal lore predicted that disaster would follow if it was ever opened, and no one knew that it held one of the great works of art of nearly 1,000 years before. The work was finished. The two men rolled the stones back into place and slowly began to descend the mountainside. Even to the last, man had given some thought to the future and had tried to preserve something for posterity. That winter, the great waves of ice began their first assault on the mountains, attacking from north and south. The foothills were overwhelmed in the first onslaught, and the glaciers ground them into dust. But the mountains stood firm, and when the summer came, the ice retreated for a while. So winter after winter, the battle continued, and the roar of the avalanches, the grinding of rock, and the explosions of splintering ice filled the air with tumult. No war of man's had been fiercer than this. And even man's battles had not quite engulfed the globe as this had done. At last the tidal waves of ice began to subside and to creep slowly down the flanks of the mountains they had never quite subdued. The valleys and passes were still firmly in their grip. It was stalemate. The glaciers had met their match, but their defeat was too late to be of any use to man. So the centuries passed, and presently there happened something that must occur at least once in the history of every world in the universe, no matter how remote and lonely it may be. The ship from Venus came 5,000 years too late, but its crew knew nothing of this. While still many millions of miles away, the telescopes had seen the great shroud of ice that made Earth the most brilliant object in the sky, next to the sun itself. Here and there, the dazzling sheet was marred by black specks that revealed the presence of almost buried mountains. That was all. The rolling oceans, the plains and forests, the deserts and lakes, all that had been the world of man was sealed beneath the ice, perhaps forever. The ship closed in to Earth and established an orbit less than 1,000 miles away. For 5 days it circled the planet, while its cameras recorded all that was left to see, and 100 instruments gathered information that would give the Venusian scientists many years of work. An actual landing was not intended. There seemed little purpose in it. But on the 6th day, the picture changed. A panoramic monitor, driven to the limit of its amplification, detected the dying radiation of the 5,000-year-old beacon. Through all the centuries, it had been sending out its signals with ever-failing strength, as its radioactive heart steadily weakened. The monitor locked on the beacon frequency. In the control room, a bell clamored for attention. A little later, the Venusian ship broke free from its orbit and slanted down toward Earth, toward a range of mountains that still towered proudly above the ice, and to a cairn of gray stones that the years had scarcely touched. The great disk of the sun blazed fiercely in a sky no longer veiled with mist, for the clouds that had once hidden Venus had now completely gone. Whatever force had caused the change in the sun's radiation had doomed one civilization, but had given birth to another. Less than 5,000 years before, the half-savage people of Venus had seen sun and stars for the first time. Just as the science of Earth had begun with astronomy, so had that of Venus. And on the warm, rich world that man had never seen, progress had been incredibly rapid. Perhaps the Venusians had been lucky. They never knew the Dark Age that held man enchained for 1,000 years. They missed the long detour into chemistry and mechanics, but came at once to the more fundamental laws of radiation physics. In the time that man had taken to progress from the pyramids to the rocket-propelled spaceship, the Venusians had passed from the discovery of agriculture to anti-gravity itself, the ultimate secret that man had never learned. The warm ocean that still bore most of the young planet's life rolled its breakers languidly against the sandy shore. So new was this continent that the very sands were coarse and gritty. There had not yet been time enough for the sea to wear them smooth. The scientists lay half in the water, their beautiful reptilian bodies gleaming in the sunlight. The greatest minds of Venus had gathered on this shore from all the islands of the planet. What they were going to hear they did not know, except that it concerned the Third World and the mysterious race that had peopled it before the coming of the ice. The historian was standing on the land, for the instruments he wished to use had no love of water. By his side was a huge machine which attracted many curious glances from his colleagues. It was clearly concerned with optics, for a lens system projected from it toward a screen of white material 12 yards away. The historian began to speak. Briefly, he recapitulated what little had been discovered concerning the third planet and its people. He mentioned the centuries of fruitless research that had failed to interpret a single word of the writings of Earth. The planet had been inhabited by a race of great technical ability. That at least was proved by the few pieces of machinery that had been found in the cairn upon the mountain. "We do not know why so advanced a civilization came to an end," he observed. "Almost certainly it had sufficient knowledge to survive an ice age. There must have been some other factor of which we know nothing. Possibly disease or racial degeneration may have been responsible. It has even been suggested that the tribal conflicts endemic to our own species in prehistoric times may have continued on the third planet after the coming of technology. Some philosophers maintain that knowledge of machinery does not necessarily imply a high degree of civilization, and it is theoretically possible to have wars in a society possessing mechanical power, flight, and even radio. Such a conception is alien to our thoughts, but we must admit its possibility. It would certainly account for the downfall of the lost race. It has always been assumed that we should never know anything of the physical form of the creatures who lived on Planet 3. For centuries, our artists have been depicting scenes from the history of the dead world, peopling it with all manner of fantastic beings. Most of these creations have resembled us more or less closely, though it has often been pointed out that because we are reptiles, it does not follow that all intelligent life must necessarily be reptilian. We now know the answer to one of the most baffling problems of history. At last, after hundreds of years of research, we have discovered the exact form and nature of the ruling life on the third planet. There was a murmur of astonishment from the assembled scientists. Some were so taken aback that they disappeared for a while into the comfort of the ocean, as all Venusians were apt to do in moments of stress. The historian waited until his colleagues reemerged into the element they so disliked. He himself was quite comfortable, thanks to the tiny sprays that were continually playing over his body. With their help, he could live on land for many hours before having to return to the ocean. The excitement slowly subsided, and the lecturer continued. One of the most puzzling of the objects found on Planet 3 was a flat metal container holding a great length of transparent plastic material, perforated at the edges and wound tightly into a spool. This transparent tape at first seemed quite featureless, but an examination with the new sub-electronic microscope has shown that this is not the case. Along the surface of the material, invisible to our eyes but perfectly clear under the correct radiation, are literally thousands of tiny pictures. It is believed that they were imprinted on the material by some chemical means and have faded with the passage of time. These pictures apparently form a record of life as it was on the third planet at the height of its civilization. They are not independent. Consecutive pictures are almost identical, differing only in the detail of movement. The purpose of such a record is obvious. It is only necessary to project the scenes in rapid succession to give an illusion of continuous movement. We have made a machine to do this, and I have here an exact reproduction of the picture sequence. The scenes you are now going to witness take us back many thousands of years to the great days of our sister planet. They show a complex civilization, many of whose activities we can only dimly understand. Life seems to have been very violent and energetic, and much that you will see is quite baffling. It is clear that the third planet was inhabited by a number of different species, none of them reptilian. That is a blow to our pride, but the conclusion is inescapable. The dominant type of life appears to have been a two-armed biped. It walked upright and covered its body with some flexible material, possibly for protection against the cold, since even before the Ice Age, the planet was at a much lower temperature than our own world. But I will not try your patience any further. You will now see the record of which I have been speaking. A brilliant light flashed from the projector. There was a strange whirring, and on the screen appeared hundreds of strange beings moving rather jerkily to and fro. The picture expanded to embrace one of the creatures, and the scientists could see that the historian's description had been correct. The creature possessed two eyes, set rather close together, but the other facial adornments were a little obscure. There was a large orifice in the lower portion of the head that was continually opening and closing. Possibly it had something to do with the creature's breathing. The scientists watched spellbound as the strange being became involved in a series of fantastic adventures. There was an incredibly violent conflict with another, slightly different creature. It seemed certain that they must both be killed, but when it was all over, neither seemed any the worse. Then came a furious drive over miles of country in a four-wheeled mechanical device which was capable of extraordinary feats of locomotion. The ride ended in a city packed with other vehicles moving in all directions at breathtaking speeds. No one was surprised to see two of the machines meet head-on with devastating results. After that, events became even more complicated. It was now quite obvious that it would take many years of research to analyze and understand all that was happening. It was also clear that the record was a work of art, somewhat stylized, rather than an exact reproduction of life as it actually had been on the third planet. Most of the scientists felt themselves completely dazed when the sequence of pictures came to an end. There was a final flurry of motion, in which the creature that had been the center of interest became involved in some tremendous but incomprehensible catastrophe. The picture contracted to a circle, centered on the creature's head. The last scene of all was an expanded view of its face, obviously expressing some powerful emotion. But whether it was rage, grief, defiance, resignation, or some other feeling could not be guessed. The picture vanished. For a moment, some lettering appeared on the screen. Then it was all over. For several minutes, there was complete silence, save for the lapping of the waves upon the sand. The scientists were too stunned to speak. This fleeting glimpse of Earth's civilization had had a shattering effect on their minds. Then little groups began to start talking together, first in whispers and then more and more loudly, as the implications of what they had seen became clearer. Presently, the historian called for attention and addressed the meeting again. "We are now planning," he said, "a vast program of research to extract all available knowledge from this record. Thousands of copies are being made for distribution to all workers. You will appreciate the problems involved. The psychologists in particular have an immense task confronting them. But I do not doubt that we shall succeed. In another generation, who can say what we may not have learned of this wonderful race? Before we leave, let us look again at our remote cousins, whose wisdom may have surpassed our own, but of whom so little has survived." Once more, the final picture flashed on the screen, motionless this time, for the projector had been stopped. With something like awe, the scientists gazed at the still figure from the past, while in turn the little biped stared back at them with its characteristic expression of arrogant bad temper. For the rest of time, it would symbolize the human race. The psychologists of Venus would analyze its actions and watch its every movement until they could reconstruct its mind. Thousands of books would be written about it. Intricate philosophies would be contrived to account for its behavior. But all this labor, all this research, would be utterly in vain. Perhaps the proud and lonely figure on the screen was smiling sardonically at the scientists, who were starting on their age-long fruitless quest. Its secret would be safe as long as the universe endured, for no one now would ever read the lost language of Earth. Millions of times in the ages to come, those last few words would flash across the screen, and none could ever guess their meaning. A Walt Disney production. If I Forget Thee, O Earth. When Marvin was 10 years old, his father took him through the long, echoing corridors that led up through administration and power, until at last they came to the uppermost levels of all, and were among the swiftly growing vegetation of the farmlands. Marvin liked it here. It was fun watching the great slender plants creeping with almost invisible eagerness toward the sunlight as it filtered down through the plastic domes to meet them. The smell of life was everywhere, awakening inexpressible longings in his heart. No longer was he breathing the dry, cool air of the residential levels, purged of all smells but the faint tang of ozone. He wished he could stay here for a little while, but Father would not let him. They went onward until they had reached the entrance to the observatory, which he had never visited. But they did not stop, and Marvin knew with a sense of rising excitement that there could only be one goal left. For the first time in his life, he was going outside. There were a dozen of the surface vehicles with their wide balloon tires and pressurized cabins in the great servicing chamber. His father must have been expected, for they were led at once to the little scout car waiting by the huge circular door of the airlock. Tense with expectancy, Marvin settled himself down in the cramped cabin while his father started the motor and checked the controls. The inner door of the lock slid open and then closed behind them. He heard the roar of the great air pumps fade slowly away as the pressure dropped to zero. Then the vacuum sign flashed on, the outer door parted, and before Marvin lay the land which he had never yet entered. He had seen it in photographs, of course. He had watched it imaged on television screens 100 times. But now it was lying all around him, burning beneath the fierce sun that crawled so slowly across the jet-black sky. He stared into the west, away from the blinding splendor of the sun, and there were the stars, as he had been told but had never quite believed. He gazed at them for a long time, marveling that anything could be so bright and yet so tiny. They were intense, unscintillating points, and suddenly he remembered a rhyme he had once read in one of his father's books. "Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are." Well, he knew what the stars were. Whoever asked that question must have been very stupid. And what did they mean by twinkle? You could see at a glance that all the stars shone with the same steady, unwavering light. He abandoned the puzzle and turned his attention to the landscape around him. They were racing across a level plain at almost 100 miles an hour, the great balloon tires sending up little spurts of dust behind them. There was no sign of the colony. In the few minutes while he had been gazing at the stars, its domes and radio towers had fallen below the horizon. Yet there were other indications of man's presence, for about a mile ahead, Marvin could see the curiously shaped structures clustering round the head of a mine. Now and then a puff of vapor would emerge from a squat smokestack and would instantly disperse. They were past the mine in a moment. Father was driving with a reckless and exhilarating skill as if, it was a strange thought to come into a child's mind, he were trying to escape from something. In a few minutes they had reached the edge of the plateau on which the colony had been built. The ground fell sharply away beneath them in a dizzying slope whose lower stretches were lost in shadow. Ahead, as far as the eye could reach, was a jumbled wasteland of craters, mountain ranges, and ravines. The crests of the mountains, catching the low sun, burned like islands of fire in a sea of darkness, and above them the stars still shone as steadfastly as ever. There could be no way forward, yet there was. Marvin clenched his fists as the car edged over the slope and started the long descent. Then he saw the barely visible track leading down the mountainside and relaxed a little. Other men, it seemed, had gone this way before. Night fell with a shocking abruptness as they crossed the shadow line and the sun dropped below the crest of the plateau. The twin searchlights sprang into life, casting blue-white bands on the rocks ahead, so that there was scarcely need to check their speed. For hours they drove through valleys and past the foot of mountains, whose peaks seemed to comb the stars, and sometimes they emerged for a moment into the sunlight as they climbed over higher ground. And now on the right was a wrinkled, dusty plain, and on the left, its ramparts and terraces, rising mile after mile into the sky, was a wall of mountains that marched into the distance until its peaks sank from sight below the rim of the world. There was no sign that men had ever explored this land, but once they passed the skeleton of a crashed rocket, and beside it a stone cairn surmounted by a metal cross. It seemed to Marvin that the mountains stretched on forever, but at last, many hours later, the range ended in a towering, precipitous headland that rose steeply from a cluster of little hills. They drove down into a shallow valley that curved in a great arc toward the far side of the mountain. And as they did so, Marvin slowly realized that something very strange was happening in the land ahead. The sun was now low behind the hills on the right. The valley before them should be in total darkness. Yet it was awash with a cold white radiance that came spilling over the crags beneath which they were driving. Then suddenly they were out on the open plain, and the source of the light lay before them in all its glory. It was very quiet in the little cabin now that the motors had stopped. The only sound was the faint whisper of the oxygen feed and an occasional metallic crepitation as the outer walls of the vehicle radiated away their heat. For no warmth at all came from the great silver crescent that floated low above the far horizon and flooded all this land with pearly light. It was so brilliant that minutes passed before Marvin could accept its challenge and look steadfastly into its glare. But at last he could discern the outlines of continents, the hazy border of the atmosphere, and the white islands of cloud. And even at this distance he could see the glitter of sunlight on the polar ice. It was beautiful, and it called to his heart across the abyss of space. There in that shining crescent were all the wonders that he had never known, the hues of sunset skies, the moaning of the sea on pebbled shores, the patter of falling rain, the unhurried benison of snow. These and a thousand others should have been his rightful heritage, but he knew them only from the books and ancient records, and the thought filled him with an anguish of exile. Why could they not return? It seemed so peaceful beneath those lines of marching cloud. Then Marvin, his eyes no longer blinded by the glare, saw that the portion of the disk that should have been in darkness was gleaming faintly with an evil phosphorescence. And he remembered. He was looking upon the funeral pyre of a world, upon the radioactive aftermath of Armageddon. Across a quarter of a million miles of space, the glow of dying atoms was still visible, a perennial reminder of the ruinous past. It would be centuries yet before that deadly glow died from the rocks, and life could return again to fill that silent, empty world. And now Father began to speak, telling Marvin the story which until this moment had meant no more to him than the fairy tales he had once been told. There were many things he could not understand. It was impossible for him to picture the glowing, multicolored pattern of life on the planet he had never seen. Nor could he comprehend the forces that had destroyed it in the end, leaving the colony preserved by its isolation as the sole survivor. Yet he could share the agony of those final days when the colony had learned at last that never again would the supply ships come flaming down through the stars with gifts from home. One by one, the radio stations had ceased to call. On the shadowed globe, the lights of the cities had dimmed and died. And they were alone at last, as no men had ever been alone before, carrying in their hands the future of the race. Then had followed the years of despair and the long-drawn battle for survival in this fierce and hostile world. That battle had been won, though barely. This little oasis of life was safe against the worst that nature could do. But unless there was a goal, a future toward which it could look, the colony would only lose the will to live, and neither machines nor skill nor science could save it then. So at last, Marvin understood the purpose of this pilgrimage. He would never walk beside the rivers of that lost and legendary world, or listen to the thunder raging above its softly rounded hills. Yet one day, how far ahead, his children's children would return to claim their heritage. The winds and the rains would scour the poisons from the burning lands and carry them to the sea, and in the depths of the sea they would waste their venom until they could harm no living things. Then the great ships that were still waiting here on the silent, dusty plains could lift once more into space along the road that led to home. That was the dream. And one day, Marvin knew with a sudden flash of insight, he would pass it on to his own son, here at this same spot, with the mountains behind him, and the silver light from the sky streaming into his face. He did not look back as they began the homeward journey. He could not bear to see the cold glory of the crescent earth fade from the rocks around him, as he went to rejoin his people in their long exile. Breaking Strain. Grant was riding up the Star Queen's log when he heard the cabin door opening behind him. He didn't bother to look round. It was hardly necessary, for there was only one other man aboard the ship. But when nothing happened, and when McNeil neither spoke nor came into the room, the long silence finally roused Grant's curiosity, and he swung the seat round in its gimbals. McNeil was just standing in the doorway, looking as if he had seen a ghost. The trite metaphor flashed into Grant's mind instantly. He did not know for a moment how near the truth it was. In a sense, McNeil had seen a ghost, the most terrifying of all ghosts, his own. "What's the matter?" said Grant angrily. "You sick or something?" The engineer shook his head. Grant noticed the little beads of sweat that broke away from his forehead and went glittering across the room on their perfectly straight trajectories. His throat muscles moved, but for a while no sound came. It looked as though he was going to cry. "We're done for," he whispered at last. "Oxygen reserves gone." Then he did cry. He looked like a flabby doll, slowly collapsing on itself. He couldn't fall, for there was no gravity, so he just folded up in midair. Grant said nothing. Quite unconsciously, he rammed his smoldering cigarette into the ashtray, grinding it viciously until the last tiny spark had died. Already the air seemed to be thickening around him as the oldest terror of the spaceways gripped him by the throat. He slowly loosed the elastic straps, which while he was seated gave some illusion of weight, and with an automatic skill launched himself toward the doorway. McNeil did not offer to follow. Even making every allowance for the shock he had undergone, Grant felt that he was behaving very badly. He gave the engineer an angry cuff as he passed him and told him to snap out of it. The hold was a large hemispherical room with a thick central column, which carried the controls and cabling to the other half of the dumbbell-shaped spaceship, 100 meters away. It was packed with crates and boxes arranged in a surrealistic three-dimensional array that made very few concessions to gravity. But even if the cargo had suddenly vanished, Grant would scarcely have noticed. He had eyes only for the big oxygen tank, taller than himself, which was bolted against the wall near the inner door of the airlock. It was just as he had last seen it, gleaming with aluminum paint, and the metal side still held the faint touch of coldness that gave the only hint of the contents. All the piping seemed in perfect condition. There was no sign of anything wrong, apart from one minor detail. The needle of the contents gauge lay mutely against the zero stop. Grant gazed at that silent symbol as a man in ancient London, returning home one evening at the time of the plague, might have stared at a rough cross newly scrawled upon his door. Then he banged half a dozen times on the glass in the futile hope that the needle had stuck, though he never really doubted its message. News that is sufficiently bad somehow carries its own guarantee of truth. Only good reports need confirmation. When Grant got back to the control room, McNeil was himself again. A glance at the opened medicine chest showed the reason for the engineer's rapid recovery. He even essayed a faint attempt at humor. "It was a meteor," he said. "They tell us a ship this size should get hit once a century. We seem to have jumped the gun with 95 years still to go. But what about the alarms? The air pressure's normal. How could we have been holed?" "We weren't," McNeil replied. "You know how the oxygen circulates nightside through the refrigerating coils to keep it liquid? The meteor must have smashed them and the stuff simply boiled away." Grant was silent, collecting his thoughts. What had happened was serious, deadly serious, but it need not be fatal. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.